welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, and welcome to our first show of the new year. You know, beginnings, even arbitrarily designated calendrical ones, offer opportunities for self-reflection and change-making, both in our personal lives and in the life of the greater society. And looking back at the year just passed, it's easy to see there's plenty of change needed in not only the way the world is run, but also in the way we great primates think about our place in it. But what are we to do? A good start, my first guest suggests, is becoming a little more conscious of the preconceptions and biases limiting our understanding. Derek Bros is a freelance journalist, community activist, gardener, and promoter from Houston, Texas, and co-author of the book The Conscious Resistance: Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. He's founder of both the Houston Free Thinkers and the Conscious Resistance Network, and hosts the weekly podcast The Conscious Resistance Live. According to Bros, consciously resisting means, quote, being willing to engage in self-reflection and pursuing knowledge of the self. Derek Bros in the first half. And there's no doubt who informs us about the world affects how we live in it. Currently, Big M Media, within the Anglo-American power configuration, is struggling to maintain the structural integrity of its narrative surrounding the ongoing conflict in the Middle East and the great refugee exodus that conflict has created. Tim Anderson is an Australian solidarity activist and academic at the University of Sydney. He has degrees in economics and international politics and a doctorate in the political economy of economic liberalization in Australia. Tim Anderson and the role frenemies play in Washington's great Middle East game in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher emeritus and CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us news of the coming week from our city streets and beyond there too. But first, Derek Bros, actively raising the consciousness level of alternative journalism. Stick around. Well, welcome to the program, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, Derek, your activism is expressed in a number of ways, a lot we can hopefully get to on your website, especially, as I've described already. But what ties these disparate efforts of yours together?
That's kind of been something I've been trying to work out myself for a while. In my personal world, I feel like I run in several circles that have intersections, that have influence and shape my activism, and that would be both, you know, political activism, political awareness, concerning myself with current events, things like that, but also being involved in meditation and, you know, more, I guess what you could term spiritual communities where I live. Both of those different viewpoints have greatly shaped the way I look at the world and from the beginning shaped my activism. But, you know, as far as the journalism bit of it, that came through just passion and really just, you know, kind of out of accident. I didn't go to school for journalism or anything. It just came out of a result of my persistent activism, and through that started writing a lot and getting opportunities to write for other people and to do it for a living. And now I'm in a position where I can, you know, travel the country and cover a lot of news that you're not going to hear in the corporate media and do it independently, while, you know, working with several different independent outlets and also starting my own outlet. So it's been a great experience.
You know, I've been doing this for a long time on radio, and I didn't go to journalism school per se either, and I've often had a hard time describing myself as a journalist. You know, I don't do that for a living. I can't make money at it up here, at least haven't been able to so far. How do you consider yourself? I mean, you know, you describe a lot of the work you do, and I would call it journalism or maybe citizen journalism. How do you describe it?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, I've done a few different types of writing that I would term journalism. You know, in the age that we're in now with the power of the internet, plenty of people, there's debates, especially among the older class of journalists and the more established newspapers and such, who they want to look down on the internet blogger, you know, or just the kid with the camera. But that's how I started, and that's how plenty of people have started. I was just, you know, all of a sudden recognizing, okay, the guy on the TV in a suit isn't any smarter than I am, or he doesn't have, you know, anything else that I don't possess. It's just that he's on TV. And so now that we have these tools, we have cameras on our phone, you can buy cheap cameras, you know, the internet, all these different, tools we have at our access now is really letting people become the new media. And yeah, I think it comes out of that old sort of muckraking journalism school, you know, older school of thought, and also people like Glenn Greenwald more in the mainstream, and he openly promotes adversarial journalism. You know, he said that journalism should be opposed to the establishment and should seek to expose them rather than just to take, you know, the statement from the quote-unquote anonymous government officials and just parrot the government line. You know, the individuals, we really are the last defense, and that is when you recognize that the media in this country and really around the world is controlled by a handful of corporations. And if you want to find real information, you got to go out there and find it yourself. So, you know, I feel like I've gone from writing blogs or whatever, you know, you could term blogs, essays, et cetera, by analyzing the news and seeing what's going on and putting my viewpoints. But I've also done a lot of on-the-ground work, going with my own camera, with my own audio recorder, asking the questions myself, you know, to Ferguson, to Boston, to Arizona, to a bunch of different places, to cover stories that I think are important, or to be on the scene whenever there's something going down and when I just don't trust that the media is going to ask the questions that I care about or that my audience cares about.
Yeah, and this is, and on your website, this is really evident, theconsciousresistance.com, again, is that site. And when you talk about guys with suits, you've got a friend. I mean, one thing that really struck me about this website is that the collaboration with various other platforms and people, and it seems more like a network. And when you talk about, you know, a guy with a suit on television on a mainstream channel, well, you're connected to one just such a guy, Ben Swan. What's the nature of that collaboration? And maybe you could describe to us up here who don't see Ben Swan, or most of us probably don't know who he is, and what's the nature of that relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. If the audience is not aware of who Ben Swan is, I do advise check out truthandmedia.com, which is Ben's current website that he runs. But he's a Lone Star. He's originally from Texas, actually, but he's a Lone Star Emmy Award-winning journalist. He's won the Edward Murrow Award several times for his journalism when he was younger. He's just a really brilliant guy. He used to work at a Fox affiliate in Cincinnati, and then he went independent after they started to basically censor him, because he does a really powerful report called The Reality Check, and just does really well-trained in that old-school style of journalism we were talking about, but also somebody who's willing to say, you know what, when I went to journalism school and the people I work with at these stations, we're taught to be broadcasters, not journalists. So, you know, he'll openly talk about when they say, hey, we can't run this Hillary Clinton, you know, piece because our advertisers or whatever. So he's been very much supported by activists and people such as myself and independent alternative media, because he's been able to crack into that world and work in the mainstream. He has that mainstream look, the suit and tie, the nice hair. You know, the middle America is going to listen to him before they probably would listen to me, based on looks, which is silly itself, but we know that that plays a role. And as far as that goes, Ben has that really well down. I started working with him in 2012 or so, around the last election. There was third-party debates were being held by a couple of different organizations, helped organize, you know, Libertarian Green Party, Constitutional Party, and some other parties. And it was hosted by RT. It was pretty much ignored by all the mainstream. And Ben was supposed to be hosting that debate. And just out of chance, you know, we interviewed one of the organizers of that event that night on a radio program that I used to do. And the guy just kind of offhandedly said that Ben Swan was no longer participating because he had been warned not to participate by the Fox affiliate he was working at. So I was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting piece of information. And the next day, you know, I woke up and I realized that nobody else had that information and that it wasn't being reported anywhere, you know, within the independent alternative or anywhere. So I put out an article and wrote it and got it out there, and it went a little viral. And then Ben ended up contacting me and basically said, he asked me to make a correction. Not, you know, he didn't say that there was anything I got wrong. He just said, those words weren't used. That's all he would really say about it. And but shortly after that, he left Fox affiliate anyways, and as I said, went independent. Now he's back at CBS in Atlanta. He's working there now. But I talk to him on a pretty regular basis, and we do interviews. You know, I definitely, as I said, have a lot of respect for him, and you know, I think the respect is mutual.
Well, you know, and I linked from your site, again, theconsciousresistance.com, to the Truth in Media site, Ben's site, and looked at some of his CBS reports, and I was amazed. Some of the things he was reporting on and the way he was reporting on it on a CBS station, I was slack-jawed watching it.
Yeah, that seems to be the response for a lot of people. You watch it, and you're like, whoa, this is on TV? This seems like there's too much truth in this for this to get played on TV.
Yeah, it's not like we didn't. It's not like most of us didn't know it. It's just seeing it in that venue. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Derek Brose. Derek, as I said, is the author of theconsciousresistance.com, a cool website. And you talked about blogging and getting into a citizen journalism, as I call it, or journalism proper, however we want to classify this. But you also moved into producing a book that I mentioned too, The Conscious Resistance: Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. Well, now, Derek, I've always had a hard time understanding anarchy, and I know a lot of other people do. They think anarchists are throwing petrol bombs or whatever. Could you give us a thumbnail of what anarchy means to you?
Absolutely. You know, and that image, like you said, conjures up in people's minds this idea of throwing Molotov cocktails or violence or chaos. And, you know, some would say that's a purposeful effort that's been done over generations, because when you really start to get beyond just that surface level understanding of anarchy and what, you know, the way it's used in more of the mainstream world and media, movies and television, and look at the history of it, you understand that anarchism is actually a philosophy of freedom that has been around since the 18th century. And the ideas, I mean, have been around for probably since the beginning of humanity, you know, but as far as in the written form and people identifying that this is a school of thought where we value these things, that's been going on since the 18th century. And, you know, just like any school of thought, any philosophy, there's a lot of different branches, there's a lot of variations, and, you know, who thinks this is the right way to go about it, et cetera, et cetera. But at the heart of it is essentially the idea that human beings are capable enough and evolving to the point of being able to take care of their own affairs and their own interactions with each other, you know, for mutual benefit, for, you know, building community and to, you know, living in a productive way that we all have grown accustomed to, but without the need for government, without the need for the state and for that inherent violence that is imposed by the state. Because, you know, if you decide one day that you don't think you need to pay taxes, or you can't find any legitimate moral reason why you owe the government money on your income, say, for example, well, then men with guns will come to your house and they will round you up and put you in a cage. And so that's one example of where you're not free. And so when you start to examine all these different areas and you see the ways that the state imposes its will, and then, of course, the employees of that state impose their will, whether consciously or unconsciously, upon you, then you realize that, you know, we are not as free as we would like to believe. Yes, there's, you know, you can argue the United States is freer than other places, but as I said, I think that we're evolving, and many thinkers have said this for a while, that we're evolving to the point of not needing a government, which, looking at the world today, can seem pretty far off. Like, wow, I think that, you know, you're insane. There's no way I can see all this chaos in the world ever coming to a point of, you know, working together in a balance. And I definitely can resonate with that statement, and I have issue with a lot of things going on in the world. But I also see change happening, and specifically in the United States and abroad, where individuals are starting to challenge this narrative, this idea that government knows best, that authority knows best, and to start to look to ourselves to, you know, for answers, and then look within our own communities for answers. And so anarchy is essentially the philosophy that says that we are each capable as individuals to come together to come to our own agreements upon, you know, how we should live and how we can organize. It doesn't mean that there is no government necessarily. It means that there's no hierarchy. There's this, like, no hierarchical above authoritarian top-down centralized control that exists. So, you know, communities could still decide how they want to handle the environment. They could still build roads. They could still take care of everything that we've become accustomed to. It would just be done. And, you know, this is where the theories diverge based on which specific path you want to take. But these things could still be done without this inherent force that I was discussing, you know, the force of government. And so it's a philosophy that questions whether government is immoral, whether the state is moral, and if we have really stopped evolving, if we've gotten to the point where, you know, things are as good as they're going to get, or if we can get somewhere that feels more free and more, you know, it provides for our needs.
Well, and the idea that there's a spiritual element to this, I find really interesting as well, because, I mean, there is freedom, and freedom, you know, in the societal sense, but there's also the freedom of soul, the freedom of spirit. Is that what you're getting at in your book when you talk about when you marry anarchism and spirituality?
Yeah, so, you know, the idea of the book, The Conscious Resistance: Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, which I do want to just throw out there for anyone who's interested that you can download it for free on the website. Go to theconsciousresistance.com. There's a book tab, and you can read all about what it's about. You can check out the chapters and download it for free. And if you like it, you can order one. But the idea with the book is myself and my co-author, John Vimes, basically, before we met, as you know, we both kind of had our own individual paths coming to this understanding of what I was just discussing about anarchist philosophy and exploring that. And we both also seem to have experiences that took us towards a place of questioning, you know, the world, trying to understand things, and different experiences, like maybe with, you know, some psychedelics or just life-changing experiences, and starting to evaluate what makes sense and all these different things, the big questions, you know, you ponder about life that kind of lead you down that spiritual, that bigger, deeper path. And upon doing that, I started to see just these incredible similarities and similar veins of thought in these two different worlds. Like I said, I delve in both political activist world and spiritual world. And on one hand, I see people who are pursuing deep understanding of what God means or what the universe means or what nature is. And they're on this spiritual path to understand themselves and the world and everything around them. And they're totally in the state of complete freedom. You know, they're not being held back by a religious institution, by a priest, by, you know, any other person. They're letting their own experience and their, you know, their self-reflection guide them. And to me, that was like, wow, that is anarchy in action. That, you know, that is powerful. So we, you know, we started having these discussions, and before we knew it, we were like, okay, I think we have a book here. And we started writing last October. We released the book earlier this year, or last year, I guess now, April 2015. And the book covers our basic philosophy. The first part of the book looks at these ideas, how we see the world as far as anarchy and spirituality. You know, what we see is that before the state came along, individuals were allowed to be free. You have indigenous communities, native communities all around the world, not just in America, but tribes of Europe, people finding ways to organize. And it wasn't perfect. We're not saying that things were perfect then, but people weren't living with this imposed force above them. There was definitely kings and there were situations like that. But we have throughout history, there are examples of people trying to live in a stateless way. And also, before the religious institutions came along and declared these certain churches to be the only path towards God or towards understanding the universe, people were free to interpret nature as they please, you know. And that's where we see that the state come along, the church come along, and they burn the quote-unquote witches at stake, or they burn the pagans at stake, the heretics at the stake. And the same thing, the people who were talking about freedom, who wanted to live without the state, the anarchists, they were demonized, they were imprisoned, they were jailed, they were, you know, the word itself was demonized. And so we're trying to reclaim that and show people from, you know, either of these categories. Because the other thing is, living in both these worlds, I see people who are on the spiritual side of things and who are interested in meditation and those type of ideas, but they have an aversion towards political ideas or philosophy because they kind of want to, they just want to talk about the good things. They don't want to think about the bad because that's, you know, going to make things worse and that kind of mentality. So I was struggling with that. And then on the other side, I was running in these political activist anarchist circles and finding plenty of people who are militantly atheists and who, you know, didn't want to have any conversation about belief or religion or spirituality or anything of the like. And so we're trying to bring these two different worlds together to show them that there's plenty of common ground. There's a lot to learn from each other. So the first part of the book does that. The second half looks at various religious beliefs, Christianity, Islam, shamanism, Buddhism, Taoism, and shows that the roots of these belief systems are actually rooted in anti-authoritarian belief, you know, that anarchist thought is common throughout history when you really look for it. And trying to give it, you know, a historical background to show people these ideas have existed. There is, you know, they're relative and they're important, they're valuable. And we've actually since then realized that that book is going to be the first of a trilogy. We're actually releasing the second book in that trilogy this April at the Free Your Mind Conference in Philadelphia. That book is going to be called Finding Freedom in an Age of Confusion. It's going to look at some different elements, but yeah, we've got a three-part thing that we're working on here, we've realized now.
Well, you certainly have the timing right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. Again, I'm speaking with Derek Brose. Derek's a freelance journalist, community activist, gardener, and promoter from Houston, and co-author of the book, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, of which we were just talking about. You know, we get a lot of American media up here in Canada, Derek, and we're watching a lot of us with great interest what's going on in Oregon right now. You know, when you mentioned libertarianism, and there's a spiritual, or at least a religiosity, a religious element to what's going on in this big standoff down in the Malheur wildlife refuge. I'm interested in what your take on what's going on down there is and how it relates to this idea of freedom and separation from the government, especially the federal government.
So I just finished an article about 20 minutes ago on this thing, and it's pretty long, but because I think these topics are, you know, they get chewed up in the media, the left-wing media, the right-wing media, the corporate media, and then everybody takes their stance, and it's like, oh, these people are racist bigots. We, you know, the government should go attack them, or the other side is just reactionary, like, oh, you know, people who are against the government, I support them, you know, and I feel like we have to encourage each other to think deeper and to look at these situations as they are, which is very nuanced. There's a lot of layers to this, and to me, I feel like on one front, there is the idea that the federal government is, you know, constantly overreaching and growing and intruding on people's lives in a number of ways, whether it's the idea of slowly taking land from ranchers or massive surveillance or, you know, whatever, you know, wars of aggression. We have a lot of examples of federal government overreach and legitimate criticisms for the federal government. And I think those are important to remember, whether or not you agree with this specific situation. You know, you can disagree with these guys and the standoff that's taking place in Oregon and still say, but hey, I think they have a right to exercise their voice. Or hey, I think that there is, you know, something legitimate to argue about the government. And I think people forget that as well. Like, we don't have to necessarily endorse every, you know, every topic that, you know, the other side talks about or every action they take, but we can see, we can still be willing to admit when the government's wrong, because all I've really seen, and this is something, I guess just more of an analysis of the media's take on this, is this, these type of situations are easy ways to divide people. And as I said, everybody takes their position, whether they think these people are this or whether they think they're that. And then, you know, we debate each other, argue, and people just stick to their biases. And I really feel like if we were able to get more people focused on where's the common ground, where can we work together, maybe I don't agree with these people taking their guns and, you know, taking over this building in this stance, but I'm willing to work with them on this area, you know, things like that. If we had more of that type of mentality and building bridges rather than breaking each other down, then I think that these, many of these problems that we're facing would be, you know, would be handled by now.
Well, Derek, it's, again, your website is really interesting. It's theconsciousresistance.com, and the links to it are myriad, and your video reports are incisive and also interesting, and I really recommend our listeners go to check it out. Thanks a lot, Derek, for coming on and telling us a little bit about us today, and I'll look forward to the second installment in your book series.
All right, thank you for having me on, Chris. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, then. Bye-bye. Now, I'm going to take a brief break, but when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the things going on a little more locally, so do stay tuned for that. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Joining me now, as oft time she does, is the CFUV radio broadcaster and the Street News of Victoria publisher emeritus, Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine, how's it going? Okay, can you hear me now?
Now I can hear you.
Oh, okay. That's a lot better. Okay. So, Janine, sorry about that. What's going on?
Well, Chris, it seems like it's time that we all make our New Year's resolution about doing what we can for the Earth. You know, Imperial Metals is getting off without any charges for the horrendous Mount Polley disaster that is a large tailings pond failure in the history of the universe, I think. You heard about that, I guess.
I read that this morning, and I came up with a catchy thing. You remember that kid who killed a bunch of people while drunk driving and never was charged? And they said he got off because it was affluenza, because he was too rich, because he, you know, blah, blah. Well, I think in this case, it's effluenza.
Ah, yes, okay. Well, there's too many fluenzas around. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, well, these guys just, yeah, they're not responsible. But I didn't read how on earth did the judge come up with the idea that the company that sat there for years and had these practices that were dangerous, and when they predictably enough, you know, crashed and ruined, they're not responsible. Why not?
Nobody's responsible. The many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars that they've given to the BC Liberals probably has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, that's very disappointing for sure, and it sets a bet, and the next one, and the next, and the next.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's it, and the whole north is being opened up. There's apparently the work camps are built for the Site C Dam. They've already started to destroy some of the forest in preparation for that, even though the final assessments have not been done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's another. Well, we've done that. We've talked about Site C on this show a number of times, and that project's going to bankrupt the province. But it's also just ridiculous, criminal. I would venture.
I'd like to thank Don Starton. He introduced me to that by writing for the Street News about it years ago. He was already, people were concerned about it, and here we are now. And the other thing that happened is that the wall brand, Teal Jones, has been able to extend their injunction to clear cut some of the last remaining ancient forest on southern Vancouver Island, and they've got an extension to March 31st. So again, the courts have intervened, and so not only does that allow them to log the area for profit, but they're able to keep people away. So if, the forest defenders who are trying to protect the forest, and or at least even show people around, like they've been trail building in there and just trying to bring people into the forest, they're no longer allowed, within a certain proximity.
Yeah.
So it's,
well, yeah, they're disappointing all around. These are all reversals, of course.
Yeah, so Happy New Year. it is Wall Brand Wednesday, so the Wilderness Committee and others organize this event the first Wednesday of every month to phone different people connected to the Wall Brand. This week it's Steve Thompson. He's the BC Minister of Forest Lands and National Resource Operations. And there's a Wall Brand Wednesday Facebook page, or you could go to the Wilderness Committee website, and there's phone numbers or email or Twitter. It's just, there's nothing else we can do, we can support the camps. There are a number of camps around the province, Indigenous people and their allies, trying to protect these beautiful, beautiful places. And we can support them, and we can write letters and make phone calls if we can't be on the front lines. There's also a call to be idle no more. Our rivers need us, and this is to do with the Site C Dam, and this is a ongoing until January 18th. So the idea, I think, is just to blitz, Like I say, support the camps, write the letters, make the phone calls, and then also there's a Burnaby Mountain action that's going to be starting up soon because Kinder Morgan is going to be trying to push through their new pipeline from the tar sands. This weekend, Chris, is the David Rovics online concert.
Right.
He's launching the Other Side 2016 World Tour. This is his kickoff show. It's Saturday at 2 p.m. PST. He's in Oregon. He's not in the part of Oregon where the crazy people are. He's, Portland.
I'm sure there's crazy people everywhere. But this is a really interesting approach he's taking to having an online concert. I mean, he's getting ready for a European tour and needs funds. And I saw on his Facebook entry the other day that he's expecting another Rovic predictably enough, May Day.
Another Rovic? What does that mean?
His wife is going to deliver into the world another little Rovic.
Oh, the other Rovic. Yes, yes, I saw the ultrasound. Yeah, how about that? Yeah. No, and the other crazy people I was referring to are the militia camp set up in the forest there. Trevor Noah did a really funny piece on it last night on the Daily Show. So David is in no way connected to them, different Oregonians. But yeah, it's nice to be able to support him and his family and listen to his very enthusiastic celebration of activism and information. He's really an amazing songwriter. So that's online at davidrovics.com.
Well, and before you go on, but before you go on, I got to say, because I saw that piece on the Daily Show last night, and it was very one-sided. And I just talked a little bit about this situation with my previous guest, and I know that you can't hear the station where you are, but this is a much more nuanced situation. And there's these guys they're from outside of Oregon that have gone and taken over this place, but the ranchers involved that have been, they've been called arsonists and everything. The case there is not as cut and dried as it appears to be. They've been the victims of a campaign by the federal government that's very interesting. There's a lot of backstory here that's not being told. So I urge people not to rush to judgment on this. And that they're the Hammond family, and they deserve a fair hearing, and they're not getting it on either side of the political divide in this argument.
All right. Well, I guess it's worth investigating further. As far as I'm concerned, they're dairy farmers, right? They're cattle ranchers. So, you know, that to me is just an element of cruelty. I don't know. I'll look more into it, though. The last thing I have for you is a Leilu Island concert fundraiser. And Leilu Island is an estuary of the Skeena River, which is near Port Edward, which is somewhere up north. And in 2014, the local indigenous communities there began constructing a camp. You know, we've heard the story. Lots of these camps, and their efforts are to stop Petronas-led liquefied fractured gas terminal and pipeline. So there's a fundraising concert on Tuesday the 12th in Vancouver at 1994 West Perth Avenue. That's Patagonia, and there's a Facebook page, Stop Pacific Northwest LNG Petronas on Leilu Island. And then finally, I just wanted to mention, you know, the Mumia case is ongoing. Right. You know, remember, we talked about he had a severe illness, and they took him to the hospital, and then all kinds of things were discovered, and including that he has Hep C. And now you are helping uncover a larger story, as I understand it.
Well, Dave Lindorf, who's been on this show many times over the years and wrote a book about Mumia, Killing Time, he's going to be on next week, and we're going to talk about that. But yeah, Mumia's got Hep C, but it's an epidemic in the prison system. It's a private prison where he is right now, and they routinely withhold medical treatment to save money, for one thing, but also as punishment. I go to guerrillaradioblog.blogspot.ca. I've got Dave's latest article just written today. There's a big court case going on right now trying to, you know, they're fighting to get medical attention while they're incarceration, the private prison. It's a huge story. There's a lot more, and it's not just in Pennsylvania. It's across America, too. But, yeah, I'm going to have Dave on next week, and we're going to talk more about this. It's a huge scandal, for sure.
Always more to talk about. Thank you, Chris.
There is. Okay, Janine, your program, The Winds of Change, alternates with Mehdi Najjari's Hidden News, Thursday mornings at 11 a.m. Next, tomorrow it's Mehdi, I believe, right?
Tomorrow's Mehdi, yeah.
Yep. Okay, well, thanks a lot for putting in the effort again, and I know it's even more difficult now that you're working this other jobs, but thanks for coming on again, eh, Janine?
Challenge. Thank you, Chris.
All right, till the next time then. All right, now I'm going to take a brief musical break, and then I'm going to try to scare up Tim Anderson down in Australia. So it might take a little bit longer than usual, but do hang fire.
Well, I was minding my business, holding the fort, and I still remember how you sallied forth. And my mind, it was busy, a warning my heart. But hell, you ain't a cowboy if you ain't been bucked off. Well, the story's familiar, the oldest tale in the West. I fell into love and the bird left the nest. Well, I guess that there's reasons we let our hard hearts turn soft. And you ain't a cowboy if you ain't been bucked off. There's all kinds, busted up, broken up, with scars you can't see. But if you ain't been bucked off and been throwed a few times, it don't count for nothing when you make that last right. Well, the years have passed quickly, and ain't nothing to say. Only I don't feel different, and you've hardly changed. Well, I guess what I was saying is I'll give one last night. 'Cause you ain't a cowboy if you ain't been bucked off. No, you ain't a cowboy if you ain't been bucked off.
Yeah, there you go. There's Corb Blunt, Canada's own. And he's going to be in town January 26th, and that's from his disc, Cabin Fever. Well, you know, there's no doubt who informs us about the world affects how we live in it. Currently, Big M Media with the within the Anglo-American power configuration is struggling to maintain the structural integrity of its narrative surrounding the ongoing conflict in the Middle East and the great refugee exodus that conflict has created. Crucial to any good yarn, of course, is the villain. In this case, the Black Hats, or IS, known variously as ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, and the Islamic State. These are the actors whose dastardliness makes anything done by us, naturally the heroes of this epic, just okay, if not actually justified. But what if ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, and or the Islamic State is not who or what the storytellers say it is? What if the story is just that, a story invented to cover the real motives behind the nightmare unleashed on Syria and the whole of the Middle East? Tim Anderson is an Australian solidarity activist and academic at the University of Sydney. He has degrees in economics and international politics and a doctorate in the political economy of economic liberalization in Australia. While his scholarly studies focus on economic development, human rights and self-determination within the Asia-Pacific region and Latin America. His latest articles, published at Global Research, explore the complex web of local and international interests at play in Syria and the and in Iraq in this latest conflict. His latest article is "The Dirty War in Syria: Washington Supports Islamic State." The evidence. Welcome back to the program, Tim.
Thanks, Chris.
I'm glad I didn't lose you in that long introduction. Now, Tim, I just mentioned your latest article. Now, you promised that there's evidence of this connection that you and I spoke about or hinted around last year, almost a year ago, last March. What's your evidence, Tim?
Yes, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence. First of all, we have to start from the point that Washington has always pursued a regime change agenda in Syria. You remember back in quite early in 2011, the mantra of Assad must go was being chanted across the Washington elite. We know now from U.S. intelligence that they said in 2012 that it was obvious that, I'm quoting now, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. They went on to say that their aim was establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and that is exactly what the supporting powers, the West, the Gulf monarchies, and Turkey, want in Syria. So you know the aim, the motive was always there for regime change and to use the extremist groups there, whatever they say about moderate rebels. Yes. We know also that most of the weapons that ISIS use are North American weapons. There's been a range of different explanations for that. But we know also that the closest allies of the U.S. have indeed been the ones supplying ISIS, and more recently we know that the ISIS oil export industry is backed by Turkey. And we know that senior U.S. officials, the vice president, the head of the U.S. Armed Forces, and Lindsey Graham, the senator in charge of the Defense Senate Committee, have all admitted that their closest allies are supporting ISIS. So the evidence is really overwhelming of indirect support through their closest regional allies. To that, we should add that a number of senior Iraqi officials, there's over half a dozen of them, have said that they believe that the US and Britain have been directly arming ISIS in Iraq. So there's really a very powerful group of evidence that goes to show that Washington has been hiding its real relationships, and it's pursuing what it said from the beginning, a regime change agenda in Syria.
Yeah, well, when we talked last March, there was a British plane had been shot down, and lo and behold, it was full of armaments destined for ISIS, ISIL, or whoever you want to call them here. I mean, does it matter who we call them, Tim? I mean, are the Americans, is this are they supporting ISIS but not ISIL? Or can we lump these things in together and say this is really all different names for the same thing?
That's what most Syrians say. Most Syrians really call them Daesh or terrorists or mercenaries. The people who are doing actual deals, you know, there's a certain amount of negotiation now where they've arranged surrenders, they call them ceasefires or whatever, and, you know, exchange of prisoners and things like that. Those people do pay attention to the names because there are indeed names of particular groups and there's a certain amount of rivalry between the groups. I think, by the way, it's in the interests of the major sponsors, like the Saudis, for example, to keep them rather separate. Remember, when you create a Frankenstein's monster, it's better to have a number of small Frankenstein's monsters from their point of view, so they don't turn on you, because there's a degree of unpredictability about arming groups of mad fanatics. But really, from the point of view of the Syrians, from the real situation in Syria, it's really all much the same thing. If you look back at the history of how the US-funded, US-armed groups had defected and taken all arms across to ISIS, 1,000 on certain occasions, up to 3,000 on certain occasions. There's a smooth, really, transition of so-called rebel groups, so-called moderate groups, across to ISIS, and most likely it's following the money flow. Effectively, the biggest, most successful group with the most resources are attracting the recruits from those other sorts of groups. But ideologically, there's no real difference between them.
Well, I mean, we've seen, I mean, Canada was caught out supporting, at least indirectly through its Jordanian embassy, the smuggling of in one instance, but only one of more than, you know, several British schoolgirls, you know, to become brides of ISIS, you know, smuggling them through Turkey, and I don't know what else they're up to. We've seen other collaborations, Israel, for example, providing medical assistance to wounded IS soldiers, and who knows, and dropping bombs on selected Syrian targets every now and then as well, using a rocket fired from way out in the Mediterranean in the last instance, blowing up an apartment building. But I mean, what's the goal here? Is it just, I mean, if ISIS was put in power and replaced Assad or some other so-called, as you mentioned, moderate Syrians, I mean, wouldn't they be turned on immediately as well? I mean, what is Syria supposed to look like, given a Western power's success here?
Yeah, you're right to mention Israel's role there, and the Israeli state has not specifically denied that they're supporting ISIS, because indeed they've promoted the idea they're providing humanitarian assistance to anti-Syrian government fighters. And when they've been questioned about which group they're from, they've said, we support them all, basically. They haven't denied that they're supporting any particular extremist group in Syria, because the aim is regime change. Because from the Israeli point of view, and of course that's not a million miles away from Washington point of view, what they fear most is not particular Islamist groups. It's the strong alliance between those states, Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah, and now including Iraq, because indeed Iraq has turned away from the U.S. Orbit more into working with Russia and Syria and Iran. That's what they feel, that's what they want to get rid of, basically. So the aim there is really regime change in Syria, and after that, Iran is still on the agenda. It's on the back burner at the moment. But it's true what you're saying, that it appears to be a horrific outcome to empower groups like ISIS across that region. But remember, they're a much lesser threat. If you look at Libya now, you see more or less the outcome of that. You've got that very outcome in Syria, where indeed al-Qaeda groups, and now they've taken the moniker of ISIS in Libya as well, people who've been fated by well-known US politicians like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, for example. So the Libyan situation, which is of course a disaster for the Libyan people, is the sort of thing that they would prefer to have to take the Syrian state, which is a relatively strong state, a relatively consistent state in terms of its pluralism, but also in terms of its opposition to the ethnic cleansing going on in Palestine.
Well, you know, when you speak about the small Frankensteins of Saudi Arabia, I wonder, I mean, after regime change, if it is successful, if Assad leaves, I don't think that there would be a single Syria as we recognize it today, but a bunch of little Syrias, little Frankensteins, if you will. I mean, do we have an indication that this Balkanization is really the goal here of a post-Assad Syria?
I think it's a plan B. I think the plan A was to have a compliant Baghdad in Iraq and a compliant Damascus in Syria. But if that doesn't work, the Balkanization is certainly the next step. We saw quite a detailed outline of this from the Brookings Institute in July last year, July 2015. Just more or less giving shape to what had been spoken on already, that the idea of weakening a country like that, and remember the Middle East has already been balkanized. Syria was already balkanized 100 years ago to create Lebanon, and then we've got Israel and so on. So that plan has been spelt out by US think tanks linked into Washington already. But as we've seen with the Russian intervention late last year, it's not going to happen, basically. And it's still being spoken about in elite circles in the US, but if you look at the principles which have been agreed on at Vienna and at Geneva before it, dismemberment of the Syrian state is specifically prohibited to whatever extent we can place reliance on those sorts of things.
Right.
But there has been a recognition of certain principles, like the Syrian people must decide the fate of Syria and that their territorial integrity of Syria is going to be maintained. So those principles have emerged, and all parties have agreed to them, but there is still that idea in the back of things that the dismemberment of Syria, the creation of a state in eastern Syria, the consolidation of the proxy armies, effectively, of NATO and the Gulf Council in eastern Syria can be maintained. I mean, there's a similar thing which has been going on longer in Iraq, and that is the particular Kurdish authority in the north of Iraq, led by Barzani, is playing a role to weaken the power of Baghdad in Iraq, too. So that's in play in parallel.
Well, when you say the Syrian people will decide, that sounds great. I mean, when somebody at the UN says it, but, you know, which Syrian people? I mean, in regards to this great diaspora that's been going on, and Turkey plays a role. I mentioned how Canada was caught out, you know, using Turkey as a transit point to get in, to get brides into Syria and who knows what else. I mean, there's also the exit strategy of a lot of these refugees and now being released from the great camps in Turkey to Greece and greater Europe. You know, what about this? You know, how are Syrians going to decide? Do they have a right of return? I haven't heard anybody speak about, you know, who's going to go. Will the Syrian people that have been chased out of Syria, will they have a right of return, or will they get first dibs? Will they get their old property, even flattened as it is?
Yeah, good point. Well, of course, they do, from the Syrian point of view, they do have a right of return, unlike the Palestinians, leaving Palestine, leaving Israeli occupied territory, also seems to have a right of return. And they would, if the war was, if the conflict was resolved in some sort of way, they would come back, those ones in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. A number have come back already from Lebanon with the liberation of Homs city. There is a trickle, a small but steady trickle of people going back into Homs, for example. Let's remember also the displaced people in Syria are mainly about 2-1 inside the country. So you've got all of those western cities, including Damascus, but also Latakia, Tartus, Suwayda in the south, Homs, have taken a lot of people from the conflict areas, from the north and the northeast. So a number of those cities, like Latakia and Suwayda, are double in size at the moment. So there is a movement of people back to their homes as the Syrian army, backed by the Russians and Iran, are gradually taking back villages in several parts of Syria. So that's not such a big issue. In terms of the Syrian people deciding, you remember that there was a presidential election in mid-2014, according to the constitution, and that the participation rate in that election was the first competitive election in many years in Syria. There were three candidates. Bashar al-Assad won overwhelmingly, but what was important about that, really, I think, is that the participation rate was 73%. So even in the wartime situation of mid-2014, there was a very, very high participation rate, much higher, for example, than any presidential election in the US in recent times. So even though there were people who weren't able to vote at that time, there was a great enthusiasm for voting, including voting in foreign countries where it was allowed, and some of the NATO countries prevented it. But so there is a constitution in Syria, there is a state, there have been elections, there are new elections planned for the National Assembly, for example, in the next 2 years, because the last elections there were 2012. The next presidential elections are planned for 2020, I believe, or 2021. But that can be changed if there is a change to the constitution. The Syrian government has always said they are open to amendments to the constitution to allow legitimate political players, political opposition, not terrorist groups. Here's what's going on in the international sphere. A definition of the terrorist groups against whom there will be no truce, and the opposition people who are legitimately being encouraged to participate in the political process. So at the moment, the substance, if you like, of the international talks are around that, defining which are the terrorist groups which are not going to be included and there will be no reconciliation and no truce, and which are the legitimate political players who can be included in the political resolution of this situation.
Well, you know, like Milosevic and Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, Assad has been typified in the media here, at least, as being like the next Hitler, and you know, anything that he says we can't believe. He has said on more than one occasion that he would step down, he would leave power if that's what a poll said. Does that have any credibility? Can we believe that, or I mean, is he just playing us for fools?
Well, he's saying that because he believes that he has significant support in the country. That's been borne out by all of the estimates, even by his enemies and by the presidential election in 2014. So really, he's talking in principle as the Russians talk in principle. You know, the problem is that the Western debate led by Washington is largely it's a regime change idea. You know, Assad mm-hmm. must go, Assad must go. It has nothing to do with international law, international principles on human rights. It's the great violator of the Syrian people's rights by claiming that outside players are going to determine who the government of Syria is going to be. That's why it's important that principle recognized and reaffirmed both in Geneva and in Vienna more recently. So, for example, the Russians say also that they don't support any particular person in Syria. They support the right of the Syrian people to determine their own political system. They're not backing away from Assad in that sense. They're just saying, let's recognize international law here. And so that is why the great consistency of the Russian position, say, as against the US position, has been that it respects international law. And the Western position has really taken, if you like, what I'd call an imperial prerogative to say that international law doesn't matter. You know, we are going to determine who are the bad guys and the good guys here, and we're going to have a solution that suits us. That's not the way it works, and it's not the way it's turning out.
Well, it seems to be the way it has been working for a long time. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Tim Anderson. Tim is an Australian solidarity activist and academic at the University of Sydney. He has degrees in economics and international politics, a doctorate in political economy of economic liberalization in Australia. He's been published in a range of academic journals, most recently in Health and Human Rights, the Pan American Journal of Public Health, the International Journal of Cuban Studies, the Australian Journal of Human Rights, Latin America Perspective, the Journal of Iberian and Latin American Studies. You get the idea. He's doing a lot. We're speaking about his article as it appears at my website, Guerrilla Radio Blogspot, and also at Global Research. It's The Dirty War in Syria, Washington Supports Islamic State, The Evidence. Well, when you talked about regime change, Tim, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I was stunned to see John Kerry, the foreign secretary, and Obama as well, saying, regime change isn't what we want. When it's clearly, that's been the drumbeat for years, and all of a sudden they turned around on that. Did I hear that wrong, or is this just rhetoric, or what?
It is rhetoric, but it's a particular type of North American rhetoric that we've become used to, isn't it? Remember, the difference between the U.S. and the European powers is that the European powers all had a colonial past, and in many respects they still want to vindicate and justify their colonial past, whereas the U.S. as the dominant world power in the last 70, 80 years has always, or even longer than that, if we go back to the Spanish-American War, there's been this idea that the U.S. has not been a colonial power, even though they purchased the Philippines and took over the Spanish possessions and so on. So there is a type of doublespeak a North American type of double speak, I should say a US type of double speak, I don't want to offend Canadian listeners, that is really always a type of a double game, you know, that we are not, we are support the freedom and the independence and the democracy of independent peoples, but with imperial language in every other respect. There are some Europeans who are frustrated with this because they really believe in something they call new imperialism. So the US language is peculiar, and you recall there's a history of this ugly thing they call plausible deniability when it comes to violence too, which was a concept developed really in context of all the dirty wars that were going on in Latin America. Mm. So it's not surprising that a similar sort of language comes back with the dirty wars in the Middle East.
Well, there's been a lot going on and a lot of changes. The Russians you mentioned earlier coming in has really spun the wheel on this whole situation dramatically. And now we've seen last week with the Saudi government going on a head-chopping spree, but killing significantly a significant Sunni cleric, that things have really hotted up between Iran and Saudi Arabia, longtime enemies. Tim, how does this play out in the context of Syria?
Well, there's another type of substitute story, I suppose, that's going around, which is to say that the Middle East conflict has something to do with a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I'd like to say that I think that's not very deep, because the role of Saudi Arabia in the Middle East is a very important one, but it's really it's better seen as a very close collaborator with the US. I mean, Britain handed over Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian monarchy, to President Eisenhower back in the 50s, and the Saudis, in my view, can't really do anything politically without approval from Washington. Arms, for example. You've got, for example, the Vice President Biden criticizes the Saudis, or has criticized the Saudis, for providing arms to extremist groups. But the U.S. arms, and the U.S. is a very tight regime of controlling the re-export of their arms. There's a government department that actually issues licenses for re-export of U.S. arms. They aren't just given out willy-nilly to other states or other terrorist groups. So there is a double game going on, of course, with Washington here in pretending that their allies like Turkey and Qatar and Saudi are out of control. Indeed, some individuals from those countries have had sanctions placed on them in the US. One man in Qatar, I remember, for their links to al-Qaeda groups. But it's a double game because the US is definitely the puppet master behind these operations.
Well, it doesn't bode well for our near future, and not even for the longer future as well. It looks like there's another. The war drums are getting ready to expand. And did I say Sunni? I meant Shia cleric. But well, Tim Anderson, we're fast out of time. But thanks a lot. And again, check out Tim's work at globalresearch.com, and you can check it out, Tim Anderson, at Guerrilla. Guerrilla Radio blogspot.blogspot.ca. Thanks a lot for coming on again today, Tim.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, then, until the next time. I want to also thank Derek Bros and Janine Bancroft for coming on, all the good folks that keep the wheels turning week in and week out up here. And, hey, stay tuned. I'll play myself out here again with more of Cor Blund. Remember, the 26th of January, he'll be here in town. Until the next time, that's all I got. But stay tuned. There's more great stuff coming. You know. I'm making out a mile an hour like I'm blitzing into Poland. Turn like the motor in a triple-decker Fokker. I'm making out a mile an hour and I drive it like a stoker. Ooh, she likes to run, baby, eat up the miles. Ooh, she gonna do it ever very in style. Ooh, she likes to run, born hair and blue eyes. Open up the throttle, baby, wide, wide, wide. Making out a mile an hour on my German motorcycle. I'm making 9 miles an hour and she's chafing at the bridle. I'm making 9 miles an hour on my sexy little cowboy. I'm making 9 miles an hour on my German motorcycle. Ooh, she likes to run and to eat up the miles. Ooh, she gonna do it in Bavarian style. Ooh, she likes to run from hair and blue eyes. Open up the throttle, baby, wide, wide, wide.
Making an animal an hour on my German motorcycle.